Part and parcels of Israel's apartheid regime has received such a scant attention because all eyes now are on Gaza, which has given the opportunity to Israeli settlers and to Israeli policymakers to actually escalate their campaign of forcible transfer and of settlement expansion.
Boudour Hassan, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Amnesty International researcher on Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. Again, we will link to Amnesty's report, headline Damning Evidence of War Crimes as Israeli Attacks Wipe Out Entire Families in Gaza. When we come back, we speak with the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Viet Thanh Nguyen about his new memoir, A Man of Two Faces, a memoir, a history, a memorial. A major talk in New York was canceled after he signed, along with hundreds and hundreds of writers, a letter calling for a ceasefire. Stay with us.
Hay por el camino del sitio mío un carretero alegre paso. En su tonada que es muy guajira y muy sentida alegre canto. Hay por el camino del sitio mío un carretero alegre paso. En su tonada que es muy sentida y muy guajira alegre canto. Me voy al transbordador a descargar la carreta. Me voy al transbordador a descargar la carreta para llegar a la meta de mi penosa labor.
Guillermo Portables, this is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Here in New York, the prestigious Community and Cultural Center, 92NY, formerly known as the 92nd Street Y, said this week it's postponing its literary reading series as it faces backlash for canceling an event with the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Viet Thanh Nguyen, who joined some 750 writers who signed an open letter in the London Review of Books calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. It reads in part, quote, "We can only express our grief and heartbreak for the victims of these most recent tragedies and for their families, both Palestinians and Israelis. But the unprecedented and indiscriminate violence that's still escalating against the 2.3 million Palestinians in Gaza, with the financial and political support of Western powers, can and must be brought to an end," they said. Over the past 2 weeks, scores of Palestinian Americans and their allies say their scheduled appearances and interviews have been canceled, venues canceled, events featuring Palestinians or speakers who've been critical of Israel's human rights record. After Friday's 92NY event was canceled, Nguyen wrote online, quote, "I have no regrets about anything I've said or done in regards to Palestine, Israel, or the occupation and war." And his event was held instead at the McNally Jackson Bookstore. He was able to talk about his new memoir. He's joining us now from Minneapolis on another leg of his book tour. Viet Thanh Nguyen is the author of many books, has just published A Man of Two Faces, A Memoir, A History, A Memorial. We last spoke to him about his novel, The Committed, a sequel to his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Sympathizer. His other books include The Refugees and The Displaced, Refugee Writers and Refugee Lives, which he edited. He's a professor at USC, the University of Southern California. We're so glad to have you back on the show, Professor, and know that you don't really want to talk about the canceled 92NY event. So let's talk about your memoir. If you can start out by laying out the themes relevant to what's unfolding in Israel-Palestine, themes of war and memory, identity, the refugee and diaspora experience, the traumatic toll of history on individuals who live through it.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me back. I certainly do think that this memoir that I wrote, which is about my life and the lives of my parents who came to the United States as refugees and who were, you know, who went through 40 years of war and colonization when they were living in Vietnam, those stories that I tell in this book and larger stories about Vietnamese refugees in general and about the war in Vietnam do have a lot of relevance to what's happening today. One of the things that I stress in the memoir is that civilian stories are war stories too. I look at the lives of my parents who were not soldiers and how they were deeply affected by war constantly. They were displaced as refugees twice. They had to leave behind an adopted daughter when they fled Vietnam for the first time. My mother had to go to the psychiatric facility in the United States three times in her life, the last time leaving her permanently disabled. And I spent a lot of time thinking about how the ramifications of war are oftentimes very visible for soldiers, because when we think about wars, we generally think of wars, soldiers, battles, tanks, and so on. But the fact of the matter is that wars usually kill more civilians than soldiers, and civilians bear enormous burdens, both of violence, but also of ongoing trauma in the years afterwards. And that trauma is also then passed on to their families, to their children. And I grew up witnessing how the Vietnamese refugee community in the United States was a traumatized community that had a very hard time dealing with its past. It was oriented towards looking to the future, becoming American, and then having the unspoken consequences of the war rippling through the family and the community. And probably the last thing to say here is that when Vietnamese Americans become Americans, it's certainly part of the narrative of the so-called American dream, of which I'm very critical in the book. But part of the complication for me is that, you know, what does it mean to come as a refugee to the United States and then become a part of a country that is a military-industrial complex and is a settler colonial society? And that's a contradiction that I try to work through in the book.
And you also deal with the issue of language, how learning and becoming conversant in English drew you away from your family. How does language, in this case English, also represent or at least stand in for other markers of difference, so race, class, culture?
I came to the United States when I was four, so I was fluent in Vietnamese at the age of four, and I still am fluent in Vietnamese at the age of four. But, you know, I immediately became immersed in English, and I really don't even remember learning English. It seemed like I was fully born into English. It became my language. It became my way of becoming an American and assimilating into American society, and especially through the use of English to read books. You know, I educated myself at the San Jose Public Library by immersing myself into Anglo-American literature, the entire literary tradition. And that, I think I understood that I should do that because that was my entryway into American society. But of course, the more fluent I became in English, the more distanced I became from my parents. I was reading The Sound and the Fury and Ulysses, and my mother was reading the Vietnamese language church newsletter. And so I think at some level, I subconsciously and then consciously decided that I had to make a choice between English and Vietnamese. I chose English. It led me to where I am today, talking to you. But the personal, cultural, psychic ramifications of doing that in terms of not being able to be intimate with my parents in Vietnamese has been painful, and probably not unique to me, but to a lot of refugee and immigrant children. And, you know, English is the language of the masters. It's the language of the colonizers. Ironically, through writing in English, I've been able to access much of the world because my books are translated into many languages. And I think partly because I've been published in the United States through English, a language that people all over the world need to know, they need to grapple with. If I was publishing in Vietnamese, I would be read by much less people.
Also, it was striking how throughout the book you've blacked out or redacted a particular name, Donald Trump. Why?
You know, I was thinking in particular about how redaction is so crucial to American society, to a country like ours. We literally redact documents, of course, for example, from Guantanamo Bay, or other kinds of declassified documents or classified documents that are revealed. And so the act of redaction is an act of visual censorship. We know something important is being said, but we're not allowed to see what that is. And to me, that's a metaphor for redaction as a whole in the American consciousness. For at least the past 20 years, we've been engaged in the forever war, and we've been engaged in other wars continuously throughout American history. And that is a matter that I think has been redacted in the general American consciousness. We as Americans generally think of ourselves as the greatest country on earth. We have a hard time imagining that we do terrible things. And so those terrible things that in fact we actually do with our wars is redacted in our own minds and in our education and in our popular culture. So that's what it really refers to. And of course, for me, I took a little bit of pleasure in redacting one person's name in particular, because in fact, I do think that is the most I could do to this particular person, that he benefits from having our names on his lips, on our lips all the time. And so if we could just stop talking about him and saying his name, that would be one way of erasing him from our history and our memory and our politics.
Yeah, if you could talk about your choice of title, A Man of Two Faces, and the subtitle, A Memoir, A History, A Memorial.
Well, I grew up in the United States feeling like I had two faces. On the one hand, I felt, living in my very Vietnamese household with my very Vietnamese parents, that I was an American spying on them, and I felt completely American growing up. But then when I stepped outside of that household and outside of the Vietnamese refugee community into the rest of the United States, I felt like a Vietnamese spying on these Americans. And so I took that feeling of duality and I infused that into my fiction, into characters like the Sympathizer, the character of that novel. For a long time, I worked out my own emotional complications, having grown up as a refugee in the United States, feeling myself to be an eyewitness to the trauma that my parents underwent. I survived that experience by becoming emotionally numb, by not feeling things, by shutting down and not dealing with what I'd seen and what I'd felt. And so eventually, though, it came time to write a memoir after my mother passed away in 2018. And I certainly wanted to write about my mother and her extraordinary life as a refugee, as a survivor, as a successful businesswoman, as a hero who, in the end, was destroyed by herself, by whatever was happening in her mind. And so there's a memorial for her in this book as well. And then finally, there's a history, because I think it's hard for me to separate the memoirs of myself and my family and the memorial I'm writing about my mother from the history of Vietnam and the United States that led to war and that led to us becoming refugees. And, you know, one of the central questions I deal with in the book with my mother is how do I know what was unique to her and what failed her inside her own body and mind from what history did to her, how history hammered her through war and colonization and famine and other kinds of terrible experiences. And that mystery is, I think, true for so many refugees and immigrants. Some survive the experience of becoming refugees or immigrants physically. Some survive psychically, and others do not. And how do we know? What is history and what is personal trauma? What is history and what is our own memories? And I try to pursue that question for my family, but also for refugees and immigrants in general, because I think as extraordinary as my mother was, and she was also utterly ordinary too, because I've talked to so many other people and they've told me stories about their refugee parents, and they've all experienced extraordinary, horrifying, terrifying things, because that was what marked that generation of Vietnamese people. So I do think that my mother, as extraordinary as she is to me, is also representative of what so many other Vietnamese of her generation went through.
Viet Thanh Nguyen, as tension grows between the United States and China, we also see a rise in anti-Asian violence. And I was wondering if you can talk about instances in your life where your family confronted violence, and in particular, gun violence.
Well, absolutely. you know, my parents opened a grocery store in San Jose in the late 1970s called the Saigon Bay. And in that time, downtown San Jose is not like it is now, highly gentrified. It was a place where only Vietnamese refugees went to open stores back then. And my parents were shot in their store on Christmas Eve when I was 9 years old. That was one of those incidents that I, you know, at 9 years of age, I didn't know what to do with. And my reaction to that was not to react emotionally, not to process those feelings. And partly that
they
was
were both shot?
They were both shot. And, you know, partly what happened is they were lucky. They were only flesh wounds. And so they were back to work within a day or two because they had to be. If they weren't working in that store, they weren't going to make money. If they weren't going to make money, they weren't going to be able to save themselves and my brother and me and all the relatives in Vietnam that they were sending money home to. And so that was a part of the refugee and immigrant life. You know, if you were shot, if you were held up, you just had to keep on moving forward because there was nobody that was going to take your place in that store. And then, you know, some years later, when I was 16, a gunman broke into our house and pointed a gun in all of our faces and told us to get on the floor. And my mother and father did. And I'm sorry, my father and I did. My mother just ran past the gunman screaming into the street. And when he turned around to go after her, my father slammed the door shut and locked it, leaving the gunman outside with my mother. And I could see her running down the street outside the living room window past all these cars, and she was screaming. And she saved our lives that way. And that was typical of my mother, being able to make these life and death decisions. So those were the most graphic kinds of violence that we were subjected to. But, you know, growing up, I think I was also bombarded just by the ever-present racism of American popular culture, because in the 70s and 80s, there were Ching Chong jokes on the radio airwaves by shock DJs. And anybody who went to the movies was watching racist Asian caricatures and things like Breakfast at Tiffany's and 16 Candles. And, of course, I was watching all the American Vietnam War movies in which the Vietnamese had nothing to say, even though this was our country and our war. Our only place in the American imagination was to be killed, to be raped, or to be rescued. That had a tremendous impact on me psychologically, so much so that when I went to high school, my Asian friends and I, we didn't have a language for ourselves, so we would gather in a corner of the campus and we would call ourselves the Asian Invasion. And so the only language we had for ourselves was a racist language. And of course, the racism in that was that Asians have never invaded the United States. If anything, the United States has invaded Asia. And so this is one of the most pernicious ways that I think anti-Asian violence works in the United States, is to deny that it even exists and to get Asian Americans to subject themselves to this kind of brainwashing and to forget a very crucial fact that is still relevant today, which is that the greatest acts of anti-Asian violence are not carried out within the United States. The greatest acts of anti-Asian violence are carried out in America's wars in Asia. That's been true for a century. And if you consider Palestine to be a part of Asia, very broadly speaking, there I see total continuity between what the United States has done in the Philippines, in Korea, in Japan, in Laos, in Cambodia, in Vietnam, and now with Palestine.
And yet we only have about a minute left, but I wanted to ask you about another of your books, The Sympathizer. It's being made into a miniseries. How did that come about, and what would you like the drama series version to convey that's perhaps distinct from the novel?
How did that come about? Well, that came about because, I mean, you know, producers were reaching out to me, and it was a long and complicated process. But the long and short of it is that we were very lucky to land the director Park Chan-wook, who directed Old Boy and The Handmaiden, a director with a beautiful visual sense, but also a grasp of politics and history and colonization. I think he's perfect for this. And he, with him, we brought on the production studio A24, which so many people love. And then that led to Robert Downey Jr. being cast by Park Chan-wook as the one white male actor to play all the white male roles in the TV series. So there's a satirical element going on there. And then through all of those, we landed HBO, and the show will hopefully air in April of the coming year. And what I hope is that with a TV series like this, I mean, one of the realities of the world is that even a good book would be lucky to sell 10 or 50,000 copies, but a TV series can reach millions. And so for decades and decades now, the whole world has been subjected to America's Hollywood's imagination of the war in Vietnam, which is a very problematic depiction that puts Americans at the center. And for just one TV series of 7 episodes, we will have all of these very talented Vietnamese actors from all over the world whose faces will be on the screen up there. Was one day plays a sympathizer up there with Sandra Oh and Robert Downey Jr. And hopefully through our TV series, we can at least budge for a little bit the representation of the war in Vietnam, and but also the representations of Vietnamese people globally as well.
You wrote in 2017, people might like to think the war is done when a ceasefire is signed. But for most people who live through a war, it goes on for decades. As we wrap up this discussion, I mean, it's fascinating that your call that led to your cancellation at a major event in New York for a ceasefire, you may have heard at the top of the show, the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, calling for that very thing. Your final thoughts?
Well, of course, I absolutely agree. And what happens during times of war, we've seen it before, and we're seeing it very vividly right now, is that wars lead to an us versus them mentality. We are good, they are evil. And it's us or them, as George Bush said about in the aftermath of 9/11. And that type of thinking is obviously very conducive to mobilizing people to fight wars. But it's also a completely wrong kind of thinking, because when we say we are good and they are evil, we're saying we are human and they are inhuman. And I don't believe that to be true. I believe that we are all human and inhuman, each of us individually, and certainly our nations as well. And when we deny our own inhumanity, what we do is we project that inhumanity onto our opponents, onto our enemies, which makes it easier to kill them, and to kill them in the name of humanitarianism. If we're human, we conduct human and humane warfare, and our enemies are less than human. We've seen it with every single war before. We're seeing it now. We need a ceasefire, in obviously order to save lives, but also to take a step back from this very dangerous thinking of us versus them.
Viet Thanh Nguyen, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Pulitzer Prize-winning author. His new memoir is out. It's called A Man of Two Faces, a memoir, a history, a memorial. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show with a new report on how U.S. policy toward Latin America has fueled historic numbers of asylum seekers. This past weekend, Mexican President AMLO, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, hosted a summit on how to address the steep rise in migration from Latin America to the United States. Participants included Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, Honduran President Xiomara Castro, Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry, and Colombian President Gustavo Petro. After the meeting, AMLO said he would ask President Biden to open a dialogue with Cuba and called for an end to the U.S. economic embargo of Cuba. Juan, you have this new report out. The current migrant crisis, how U.S. policy toward Latin America has fueled historic numbers of asylum seekers. The report published by the Great Cities Institute, where you are in Chicago, where you're also a fellow. Can you lay out what you found?
Yeah, Amy, I think the key aspect of the report is that we've had a lot of attention in the past couple of years to the historic surge in migration across the border. But there have been few media accounts that have examined the direct responsibility of our federal government in fueling this current crisis through its foreign policy. And also, those narratives in the media have largely failed to acknowledge the long history of U.S. intervention and wealth extraction in the region, and the decades of neglect of Latin America by all administrations, Democratic and Republican, of the last 60 years. And so one of the most interesting things is that the report outlines the evidence that it's U.S. economic warfare against three specific countries, Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua, that is a significant cause of the latest migration surge. For instance, The migrant flow to the United States has changed dramatically. A few years ago, during the Obama administration and the Trump administrations, we were talking largely about of migrants from Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. That has changed almost completely. Venezuelans, for instance, back in 2020, there were only 4,500 Venezuelans that were apprehended at the southern border. That's less than 3 years ago. Now we're up to 265,000 in the first 11 months of the of this past fiscal year, FY 2023. The same thing for Nicaraguans. A couple of years ago, it was 3,100 that were encountered at the border. This last 11 months of this past fiscal year, 131,000. And, of course, Cubans. 14,000 Cubans were found, were apprehended at the border in 2020, 184,000 in 2023. And we're seeing this enormous increase from these three countries. What do all these three countries have in common? They are all being subjected to United States sanctions, economic warfare that is reduced and really crippled the economies of these countries. Venezuela, for instance, between 2017 and 2020, lost about between $17 and $31 billion in oil revenues because as a result of U.S. sanctions. Now, we're just hearing this past weekend, after our report came out, that the United States is beginning to temporarily limit the sanctions. It's allowing Venezuela for the first time now in several years to sell oil back into the United States. But the sanctions have inflicted enormous harm on the Venezuelans. And the other interesting thing to note is all the media attention has been focused on the Venezuelan migrants. Almost as many Cubans have entered the United States in the last 2 years as the number of Venezuelans who have entered the United States. And in fact, the flow of people from Cuba in the past 2 years has been greater than any time in history. More Cubans have come to the United States in the past 2 years than did after the Cuban Revolution in 1959, than did during the Mariel boat lift of 1980, than did during the Bacero crisis of 1994. This has been the largest flight of Cubans into the United States in history. The difference is that most of the Cubans are settling in Florida, where there is already a large Cuban-American community that is helping them to integrate into into U.S. society. So it's not gotten as much national attention. But there is an enormous problem in the Cuba migration as well that the United States is confronting. So I think that's one of the interesting things. All of this surge is a direct result of our government's economic warfare against particular countries. So I think one of the things that the report urges is that the Cuba embargo has to end, the Venezuela sanctions have to end, and the Nicaragua sanctions have to end if the flow of migrants from these countries is going to be reduced. The other thing that the report shows is the historic neglect of the United States to Latin America and the Caribbean. This past year, the United States gave total foreign aid to all of Latin America and the Caribbean of $3 billion. $3 billion. Compare that to the $113 billion that went to Ukraine, or as much money went to in foreign aid to Latin America, which has 650 million people, as went to Israel. Israel had about $3.8 billion in aid. Of course, it's about to get a lot more. So the inequities in the U.S. foreign aid are not helping to lift Latin America, creating the sanctions are reducing the ability of people to survive in the region, and then we're surprised by all these people appearing at the border. And so I think that's the main lesson that we have to learn. And also, of course, President Biden now is urging about $14 billion in his new package that he's proposed to Congress for border security. Here's one interesting fact most people are not aware of. The Migration Policy Institute reported this some time back. The United States spent $333 billion between 2003, when the Department of Homeland Security was created, and 2021 for agencies that carry out immigration enforcement. I'm going to repeat that. $333 billion for immigration enforcement and for ICE and border patrol and fences. And what do we have? The highest level of migrant crossings in history are occurring right now. All that money did nothing to slow the migrant flow. So obviously it's sort of like money for prisons. It's wasted money.
Juan, we want to thank you so much for the report. And we're going to link to it, the current migrant crisis, how U.S. policy toward Latin America has fueled historic numbers of asylum seekers at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for Democracy Now!
Fun Drive is coming. 20 years of awesome radio. Donate to CJSF 90.1 FM's annual Fun Drive next week, October 30th to November 5th.
You are now tuned into CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Want to know more about the channel? Find us online at cjsf.ca.
Dear listeners, as you